Education Committee, where I have worked for the past 5 years. And before that, worked in the Department of Human Services, so I am a little bit familiar with the agency, at least, and what it does. And, I look forward to working with all of you and learning a lot.
Thank you. Then we'll turn to our agenda. The purpose of the meeting today is to get an update from both the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health on the stimulus money that they are receiving and in some cases dispersing to others, in other cases using themselves within the department, and finding out how much they're getting and find out how they're complying with the federal reporting requirements and what parts of the state, if they're dispersing the money, are getting it, and any other questions that we might have about that money. And we'll start today with Jane Rankin. Is Jane here? Yes, there she is. And we're going to start with the FMAP dollars, food support dollars, and the state stabilization funds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jane Rankin. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services. And I am going to be using the handout that you have in your packet that's entitled American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, ARRA, Stimulus Funding at DHS. What I wanted to do is, as the chair said, to provide an update to you all on the stimulus funding that's going through this agency. Just to remind you that since the stimulus bill passed last February, the largest amounts of stimulus money that's going through DHS are in programs where the mechanisms to receive and spend the money are more automatic. This is the MA program and also food support benefits. And then there's another set of programs that got increased federal funding and that was in existing programs. And the program experts at DHS are going to talk through details on spending and information about those programs. So for FMAP, the stimulus bill temporarily increases the federal share of funding for FMAP for Medicaid expenditures. And that went into effect on October 1st of 08, which is federal fiscal year 9. For three quarters, the federal share of MA has gone up from 50% to 60.19%. Then in April, the federal share that we qualify for of this increased FMAP went up another 1.5%. And the reason for that is that in the stimulus bill, as you may recall, there was a base increase that all states qualified for, and then there were two additional tiers of increased FMAP. And those two additional tiers, a state qualified for it based on our unemployment rate. And last session, we were forecasting, Mr. Hoffman's forecast was that we were at the middle level of qualifying for FMAP through our state fiscal year 9, and that we would then move to the highest level of FMAP, the beginning with state fiscal year 10. What happened with our experience turned out that we moved up to the highest level of qualifying for FMAP one quarter early. So we got a little bit more stimulus money in state fiscal year 9 because for that last quarter, we've qualified for the higher amount.
And how much was that in total dollars more than we had projected in the forecast?
In total dollars, it was about $30 million additional. We had been expecting about $470 million in just measuring the increased FMAP for fiscal 9. And as you can see on the handout in front of you, we ended up earning and paying out $508 million for state fiscal year 9. The increased FMAP continues now through December 31st of 2010. We have preliminary numbers for you that as of the end of the first quarter of the state fiscal year 10, which ended on September 30th, that the stimulus increase in FMAP was $279 million. And the majority of the MA increased FMAP is paid out of our MMIS claims processing system. And that system makes biweekly payment runs. Any provider that's billing for eligible Medicaid services is getting the stimulus funds. And just as a reminder, it's not that they're getting an extra bump in their reimbursement. They don't see that their check includes more stimulus funds or stimulus funds at all. But the logic of the claims processing system is that it's paying each claim from three different pots of money, from a state general fund appropriation, from the 50% FMAP that we get reimbursed by the feds, and then from the increased FMAP as well. So all of this money is going out statewide, and it's going out to, as I said, any provider that's billing for eligible services.
And so the $30 million increased federal money reduced the amount of state expenditures that would have been made during that quarter otherwise, or during that period of time otherwise.
Yes, Madam Chair. It was an increase that was not expected at the time that we were doing the February forecast. Another large kind of stimulus money is one that is more automatic, but DHS sees it because we handle the benefit processing for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. This is the food support program, and it is both food support for families on MFIP, but it's also food support for families who are just households who are just applying for and qualifying for SNAP food support, what used to be called food stamps. What we know is that the stimulus bill increased the monthly food support benefits amounts by 13.6%, and that increase went into effect as of last April. And it is going to stay at the effect of this increase in the stimulus bill is a little bit hard to calculate specifically, because what happens is in food support every October there's typically a COLA that's applied to the benefit levels. And that's been running, it can be a 3% COLA a year, or I think the average that I saw was a little more than that. But at any rate, the stimulus increased it all at once by 13.6%. And the benefits now are to stay at that higher level until the point when the normal COLA that happens in every October will catch up. So from April until we're caught up, the food support households are seeing a benefit of, it looks like, about an average of maybe $40 a month in increased support for their food purchases.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question on that?
Certainly.
Madam Chair, then. Right. So then it might take 5 years for the COLA, if the COLA is 2.5 or 3%, it might take 5 years before it catches up to that 13.6% increase. So there'll be no increase until it catches up. Correct? Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair and Senator Corrin.
I understand.
So what we have seen and what we can report is that in state fiscal year 9, the value of the increased in food support benefits for both, this is both MFIP and just regular food support households, was $18.3 million in fiscal 9, and in the first quarter of the new state fiscal year, our preliminary estimate is an additional $19.1 million in food support benefits. The other thing I wanted to mention in this area is this is one of a few areas where there's been an increase provided for administrative costs. Most of the other programs most of the other kinds of stimulus funds at DHS don't have an administrative allocation, but food support is one that does. And we have spent $1.4 million of the administrative funds. 80% of that has gone out to counties to reimburse them for their administrative costs, and the 20% has stayed at DHS, and that has covered our costs in our Maxis system, which had to be reprogrammed to account for the increased in the food benefits. Now, the next part of the discussion of stimulus funds at DHS is going to shift to funds that the legislature, that you directly appropriated to us for fiscal 10, fiscal 11. And as you know, the fiscal year has just started, so most of the programs we're reporting on now, you will see that there's not as much information we have yet about the dollars being spent. But what we have is in front of you. You may remember that in the stimulus bill, within the education funding area of the stimulus bill, there was funds set aside to be used by states for general purpose assistance. And you appropriated $110 million of those state fiscal stabilization funds to DHS for the fiscal 10 appropriation in state-operated services and the fiscal 10 appropriation in the MSOP, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And in...
I think actually we didn't, but we agreed to allow you to change it because there was some regulation in the stimulus funding that said you couldn't use it for any.
Madam Chair, you are correct, and you are recalling that we couldn't use federal dollars to claim federal reimbursement.
I thought it had to do with not being able to use it for maintenance of buildings.
Madam Chair, that is also correct, and that was a new guidance that we just found out about in June.
Right, and so then we just agreed informally to switch it over to the sex offender program, which originally we hadn't appropriated it for that program.
In order
to give you the same amount of money that could be used.
Let me provide the context for everyone. The appropriation for state-operated services was $83.5 million for state fiscal year 10, and that essentially was the entire operating appropriation for the Minnesota Security Hospital and the MEDO program. And then, as the chair recalls, we learned that there has been an interpretation from the U.S. Department of Education, which is what we would call the cognizant agency, the one giving the guidances for this type of stimulus money, that specified that we were not to use any of the state stabilization stimulus money for maintenance. And because we have in our operating budget at the Security Hospital and at MEDO funds to pay for ongoing maintenance of the facilities. Then we did work to figure out a way to essentially swap out stabilization funds. We assigned them to some salaries at Anoka RTC in that program that don't have anything to do with either claiming federal money or paying for maintenance. And then we've shifted a like amount of general fund dollars into the Security Hospital and MITO. And that holds the activities harmless, and so it works well for budgeting. The one thing that I will mention that it will have an effect on is reporting, but I'll get to that in a little bit. At this point, for state-operated services, we have budgeted then the stabilization money all for operating expenses, and at this point we've spent $15.5 million of those stimulus funds through the first quarter of the fiscal year 10. In the sex offender program, it was a different dollar amount of stabilization money. It's $26.5 million. All of those funds are budgeted to pay for a portion of personnel costs. And so it's going out every 2 weeks with the payroll run. As of the end of the first quarter of fiscal 10, $4.1 million of the stabilization money has been spent through MSOP. At this point, I would like to shift the attention to the block grant programs in the agency that have had an increases of stimulus funding, and there are program folks who are going to come up and talk to you about that.
Are there any questions before Ms. Rankin leaves the table about her presentation?
Just one question, Madam Chair. Thank you. Ms. Rankin, back to the food support benefits, Maxis Systems cost. What is Maxis? Is that kind of like Health Match?
Chair and Senator Coring, Maxis is the computer system that DHS uses to do eligibility processing for all of our cash assistance programs. And so it is, it's a very old program, it's a system. It's been around a long time, but when county workers are in working with an eligible family or someone who's applying, they're using the Maxis system for calculations and confirmation of eligibility and benefit determination.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I guess not. Thank you. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Rolf Haig. I'm here from the Minnesota Board on Aging. And I'm going to give a presentation on the two pieces of stimulus funding that came to the Board on Aging as the State Unit on Aging. As you can see from the handout, we received $1.04 million for congregate dining, which is Title C1. Of the Older Americans Act, and $513,000 in Title C2. The legislature reduced the amount of the state appropriation by $500,000 and replaced those funds with proportionately the ARRA funds. The funds have been distributed to the area agencies on aging based on the population-based intra-state funding formula that's used for all the Older Americans Act funds and the state appropriation for senior nutrition. That happened July 1st, so that as of actually close of business on Monday, we had spent $934,000 of the stimulus funding. for senior meals. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? And is there any special reporting, or is this the same reporting that you would do for the other federal funds you get for the...
Both, we piggyback, since this is an increase in existing fund, Madam Chair, since this is an additional amount of money for existing programs rather than create additional work for contractors or anyone else, it made sense to us to piggyback it on the existing reporting formulas and timelines. And so it's been relatively straightforward and relatively simple for contractors and area agencies so far, and we're hoping it remains relatively straightforward and simple for the board.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members
Welcome.
Of the committee, my name is Deb Swenson-Klatt. I'm with the Department of Human Services Child Development Services Unit. And I, with my colleague Sheree Katilnik, will describe to you some of the uses of the ERA funding for the Child Care Development Funds that come to Minnesota. ERA temporarily increased funding for CCDF in Minnesota by $26 million. And CCDF funding comes to states for two general purposes. One is for direct services to support child care subsidies for families, and the other is to support quality improvement activities for child care providers. And I'll talk for a few minutes about the uses of the ERA funding for those quality improvements. The legislature directed Department of Human Services to use the $3.4 million in increased quality funds for three different purposes. The first is to extend a grants program that supports family, friend, and neighbor caregivers that was begun in the previous biennium. That grants program was funded with one-time funding and would have ended June 30th, 2009. But with ERA funding and the legislative direction is extended for two more years. Six grantees around the state are supported with those funds at the local level, again, to work with this informal type of child care provider to help them improve the quality of their care and support school readiness for the children in their care. The second purpose of the ERA quality funds is to support the continuation of a pilot quality rating system for early childhood programs. This quality rating system, which is called Parent Aware, was launched by a private foundation, the Minnesota Early Learning Fund, in 2007, and was set to expire this fiscal year. These funds continue it for another year, and it's currently operating in several communities around the state, including Minneapolis, the city of St. Paul, the Wayzata School District, and Blue Earth and Nicollet counties. So funds, ERA funding to support that pilot have been obligated through contracts to several community organizations to continue that initiative. And then the third use of ERA quality funds for child care quality improvements is intended to support training, coaching, consultation, and other supports to help child care providers across the state prepare for a possible voluntary statewide quality rating system. That funding is also obligated in contracts, with the exception of one RFP that we'll be releasing funds through towards the end of this calendar year. And those funds will be supporting activities like developing and delivering training resources for providers who care for infants and toddlers, building the capacity of our professional development system to support providers who are interested in participating in a quality rating system, and then delivering training and consultation around improvements that providers can make to, again, participate in a possible future voluntary quality rating system. So in all told, our funding for quality funds is obligated in contracts that all began July 1st of this fiscal year. Grantees are beginning to have begun over the course of this first quarter to implement the activities in their contracts. With that, I'll turn it over to Cherie.
In the remainder of this, my name is Cherie Kotelnik, and I work with the Department of Human Services, and I manage the Child Care Assistance Program. The remainder of the funds in the ARRA CCDF stimulus were about $26 million, or $22 million, and they were allocated to the direct services. The breakdown of that was into three categories also. $4 million per year for 2010 and 2011 were allocated to the basic sliding fee program. Counties have been informed of the funds that are available to them and increased the calendar year allocation available to counties in calendar year 2010 by $4 million. And the funds were allocated out based on a formula designed to get the money to counties with waiting lists, so it gets to the area with demand. There are about 7,000 families on a waiting list throughout the state. And they were also informed that this this level of funding would be available through 2011 so that they would not be worried about adding families and having to continue them without sufficient funds in future years. So we're trying to help them manage it as best they can. Almost $6 million was allocated to support the forecasted growth in the MFIP child care program. And that program is forecasted to be available to all families who are on MFIP or transition year and to support the costs of child care up to the needs based on their eligibility. And that program is projected to grow in the next couple of years. And so this was funding the increased potential for state funding in that area. That has been implemented because it was added to an existing program. The program parameters were not changed as they might have had to be without the ARRA funding, and the funds will continue to be available. Another $106,000 was appropriated to support the administrative costs of continuing the School Readiness Connections pilot project. That project is continuing. The evaluation results are due in December of 2009. And about 240 kids are still being supported through the changed program parameters that this program has, the sub-program of child care assistance has. The legislature appropriated the CCDF money to be spent by September 30th of 2010 and also gave the commissioner authority to expedite the expenditure of the ARRA money. As a result, we are claiming the money more quickly than we would have otherwise. So we have claimed about a quarter of the funds available to the Child Care Assistance Program. $5.65 million have been spent in the first quarter, and $2 million of that was under basic sliding fee and $3.65 million on services under the MFIP Child Care Program.
And so do you have any estimate of how many children on the waiting list will be served with the one-time money?
Counties are in the process of gearing up now. The actual increased funds are available to them in January of 2010, but they generally run through a process of sending out applications, seeing how many people are still eligible or whether their circumstances changed, and then trying to get them on. We can certainly ask counties how many families they've added since the start of this, but we have not started that yet.
Okay, well, I think people would be interested. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on that same line of thinking, you indicate that $8 million has been set aside for this. The balance will be spent, MFIP and Transition Year Child Care Assistance Programs. And so that makes me feel like I'm interpreting this to think that all of these families, all these people on the waiting list are being served, and I'm not sure if that's the case or not. And if I could just ask, on the one hand, it seems as if, you know, it's great that these dollars are coming forward. I sense that there is some frustration out there that these funds, these stimulus dollars, haven't yet made it to Minnesota families. Is there any? It seems like it's taking a long too long to get the dollars there. And is that because my interpretation is that we have a waiting list, and so wouldn't I call that family and say, good news? And I'm not able to make that call yet and say, good news.
Senator Lynch, I believe counties are calling their families and not calling them. They're sending them out a piece of information saying, your name has come up on the waiting list and you're eligible to apply. But this is a complicated program, and a person will make application, and then the county will have to figure out, based on verified information, whether their income is within the program parameters and whether the family is still in an eligible activity, and they will have to process this. That can take 30 to 45 days. Then the family actually uses the services and the provider bills, and that's another probably 2 weeks to 30 days before they bill and the payments go out. So while activity is happening and people are ramping up, we don't see the bills for a while.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one final question. And backing up, I was looking at your Parent Aware Quality Rating System pilot. And is it a true statement that as these federal stimulus dollars came in to the department, then the department collectively, you made some decisions as to where those funds would be directed? And I'm just citing that parent aware system as an example. But would that be how that happened?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, the stimulus funds that are supporting the parent aware pilot going forward are being used for the same purposes and funding the same grantees that had been funded with the MELF, Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, funding from the start of the pilot. So the pilot is really continuing in the same shape and form as was started by those private dollars. The department has made no changes to the pilot going forward, except that it will continue for one more year beyond the point at which it would have ended, which it would have ended June 30th, 2010, but will now end as a pilot July 30th, 2011.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'm Connie Greer with the Department of Human Services. I'm going to speak to you about four streams of ARRA funding. I believe you've got a handout on each of them. The first one is the Community Services Block Grant. Minnesota received about $12 million in ARRA, Community Services Block Grant funding. That funding is basically goes to community action agencies to do poverty-ending work. There's a handout that you have which says CSBG on the top of it, and on that page it describes the purposes, which basically are to go to community action agencies to do job stimulating work, supporting people in jobs, and making progress towards sustaining jobs. This funding is to be used at 200% of poverty. And there's a chart that shows how much money each community action agency received. The money goes out statewide. The money was distributed based on the state law, which governs the distribution of community services block grant funds. 28 community action agencies and 11 Indian reservations received those funds. It's quite a long list of agencies in your handouts. Outcomes are expected to be saving over 850 jobs and creating approximately 700 more jobs. These grants took effect July 1st, and agencies provided their first report to us yesterday.
And Are there certain guidelines that these agencies have to use when they're reporting the use of the money?
Madam Chair, the agencies utilize a system, a federal system called ROMA, Results Oriented Management Accountability. They provided an outcome-based work plan, and they will be using that federal reporting structure in order to report back on both outputs and outcomes for this funding. The next stream of funding is homeless prevention and rapid rehousing. It's funding from HUD, and DHS received $10.9 million. This funding was basically for a balance of state. Some other jurisdictions within the state of Minnesota also received this HPRP HUD funding. Those locales were St. Paul, Minneapolis, Duluth, Hennepin County, Dakota County, and St. Louis County. And so this balance of state funding of $10.9 million went out to serve those areas, not the individual areas. We did a competitive RFP, and 30 entities were selected. And there's you have a list of the agencies that received that funding. These will be two-year grants, and the grants take effect September 30th of 2009 and will go for 2 years. There's a list of on your handout, title HPRP overview and grantee list, a list of the kinds of activities that HUD is expecting. This is basically a consolidation of a variety of activities and basically a new program for us. HUD has not been totally clear yet in the kinds of reporting, and it's been a bit fuzzy. Many pages of information, so we understand that it is for rapid rehousing and homeless prevention, and some of the reporting we hope will come clear to us very soon. But basically, the only report that we're submitting to the feds as far as the OMB 1512 reporting for the 10th of October is that these grants are in place, and our first obligation was to ensure that grants were encumbered by September 30th, and we've done that. Indeed, the grants do cover the entire state of Minnesota. This is one grant where DHS does receive some admin money. We share 5% with the local grantees. So for the two-year period of time, we have $271,000 or $135,000 annually for admin for these grants.
And when you say you share it, how much is DHS keeping and how much do the local communities get?
The total amount is 5% admin. DHS is keeping the $271,630 to be used over 2 years, and the local entities have $271,630. They also, it's a very broad definition for them at the local level in terms of use of admin, and they have some other resources that they can use to do their reporting as well.
Okay.
The next stream of...
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You've indicated that I think just yesterday you've gotten your first results, if you will, from these agencies. But do you have any indication that any of these entities are feeling overwhelmed or feeling like they are having difficulty in distributing and getting those monies out to Minnesota families?
Madam Chair and Senator, I think that community action agencies have a lot on their plate right now. We know that they have a variety of stimulus dollars. For the most part, these are the same agencies that are doing weatherization. They're doing Head Start. Some of them are doing homeless programming. Meetings that I've been involved in with them, they say that, they know that they've been begging for money for many years, and they believe that they're up for the activity.
I'm sure their demand is up, too. So it's not like they have to go searching for clients.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Senator Berglund?
Yes.
Sharon. May I ask, Senator Lynch, are you hearing something that I'd be interested to know what it is that you're hearing so that perhaps we can have some response to it or dialogue about it, if you don't mind?
Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I do hear that while the influx of the stimulus dollars are a positive thing, that it is a bit overwhelming for some of the local jurisdictions. And I am trying to better ascertain if that's more broad-based, if there's something that we can do to assist with that. Are some of these administrative dollars, do they need to be redirected? I just think that it's really important. People are hungry to see those stimulus dollars at work, and I sometimes feel as if there's a bottleneck. And so I'm just interested to know if there's something that we can do within our purview to assist.
Madam Chair, for the Community Services Block Grant Funds, we have very preliminary information. The reports that came in yesterday, out of the $10 million, we think that about $1 million has been spent and that they have already created 135 jobs. So we know that they're very, very busy, but these grants have been in place since July, and we think that they're getting out and they're working pretty quick.
Thank you. You want to continue then?
The next stream of funding is the Emergency Food Assistance Program. You have a handout identified TFAP, the Emergency Food Assistance Program. This is the commodity distribution program, and resources come to DHS and the state in the form of both food and funds. U.S. Department of Agriculture has directed that we utilized half of the funding resources in fiscal 09 and the other half in 10. We received $361,000 for FY 09, federal FY 09, and we were also having $361,000 for FY 10. Those resources are forwarded by DHS to Hunger Solutions to be used by the six statewide food banks to go onto the food shelves to cover the costs of storage, transportation, handling, and processing of the commodity food. The total pounds of food that we received, additional food that we received through the stimulus funding for 09 was 1,032,834 pounds. We're expecting a similar amount of FY10 food to come in, and these two resources are used to cover the cost of distributing them. This program has received a significant increase in food and at the same time, as the chair has noted, increase in demand for services as well. The last stream of funding is FEMA funding. For the FEMA funding, the Department of Human Services does not receive the FEMA award of $755,000, but rather we convene the statewide set-aside committee that makes a determination about how this funds should be utilized. We convene that committee, and on the handout labeled FEMA, you can see that the committee, which is constituted consistent with direction from federal FEMA, determined that the funding should go out to counties based on the three figures, unemployment, public assistance, and energy assistance. The only money that flows through the Department of Human Services is $3,779 of admin, which is our amount for convening that committee, which we pass on to the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless to do training.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the group, my name is Jane DeLage. I'm with the Department of Human Services. I work with the policy for the Minnesota Family Investment Program, and I'm here to talk to you about the TANF emergency funds. The TANF emergency funds are funds that the states can request on a quarterly basis for three purposes. One, the increase in the caseload. Two, increases in short-term non-reoccurring benefits. And three, subsidized employment increases. And the grants are reimbursement for spending over the base year target, and it's up to, it's 80% of any spending above the base year, and it can be up to 50% of the state's family assistance grant. But as I said, you, unlike some of the grants that we've talked about, there wasn't a set amount that we received. We have to earn it and apply for it quarter by quarter. Based on our estimates, Minnesota expects to receive $44.3 million in TANF emergency funds over fiscal years 09 and 10. In July, we applied for TANF emergency funds for all four quarters of 09 and based the application on expected increases. We received $8.3 million for basic assistance for caseload increases, and that is both increases in the amount of the grants that are issued and the number of families served. That goes into the TANF fund and is used for the cash assistance. We also received $2.8 million for short-term non-reoccurring benefits, and that is money that's spent in the counties through their county emergency assistance programs. And the funds are used to reimburse the counties for any expenses that they incur that are above their spending in the target year. So when a county reaches the target for the quarter compared to the base year, then the money is drawn from this fund at the state, and they only pay up to what they had paid in their base year. And we have seen that 30-some of the counties have exceeded their base year expenditures in the last, already in August of the last quarter. So we expected to be about 30% over the base year in the first quarter of the state fiscal year, last quarter of the federal fiscal year. 45 of the counties applied to, or didn't apply, but submitted revised crisis plans in which they showed that they would spend more for more people. They, looking at eligibility, some of them upped their eligibility to 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. Some had been lower than that. They also would spend more frequently. Some had limits of once in 12 months, once in 18 months, and some of them are now allowing someone to have funds more than once in a calendar year. They also are covering some additional things. The feds are allowing us to interpret a little bit more broadly, and with more money we can interpret a little more broadly what a episode of need is. And so we're seeing that there are some additional things that counties are covering under their emergency assistance that they were not able to cover in the past because they had limited funds. The money is available to all counties statewide. We also had $2.3 million for subsidized employment, and that is spent on wages for people who are put into paid work experience positions and for the supports around those wages. And that will be used to expand and continue the supported work efforts that were begun with money from the that was dedicated to that by the legislature. And we did receive increases last year to help us to maximize the reimbursement here from the federal government. We actually have applied. We have an application in for $7 million more for the first quarter of federal fiscal year 2010. We apply, as I said, once a quarter, and we can revise our estimates at that same time so that we're getting reimbursed for what our actual expenditures were. The most recent submittal, it was $3.3 million for basic assistance, $2.4 million for short-term non-reoccurring expenditures, and $1.3 million for subsidized employment. So the money is out there. Counties are spending more to help families in need through the emergency assistance program. They're placing more people into subsidized work positions. We're exploring new partnerships in subsidized work, such as with the Department of Transportation. And, of course, the caseload increases and cost increases are being incurred and covered. So,
and do you believe that we are maximizing the amount of money we can get through our TANF program?
I believe that we are certainly working with our county partners to try to do that, to spend down the amount of money that was given for subsidized work so that we can earn additional money, and we're pushing that that be wages. We also have done our best to encourage counties to liberalize to some extent their EA policies so that more people can be served and helped through these projects. So to the extent that we're reliant on counties doing their part of this, you know, we are out there trying to encourage them to use this as an opportunity to help some families while we can, to get them into subsidized work so that they can get into permanent work positions. We're doing the best we can, I think, to do that.
Okay.
We've issued bulletins and emails and met with county people on a variety of occasions.
Are there any other questions on this issue?
Well, I might as well ask. And when you say that, in response to Senator Brooker's question, are we doing what we can to spend down and get and take advantage of this program? And you're responding that you're sending out notices, you're trying to communicate. Is that working? Are the counties being responsive? Are we in fact having it happen?
We are seeing increases in the use of subsidized work and in the emergency assistance programs. It's steadily increasing. I think there was some initial reluctance and concern that maybe they wouldn't actually be reimbursed for the expenditures under the emergency assistance, and since we've been able to actually even go back to the first two quarters of the calendar year and reimburse overspending, we're seeing more spending going on, and counties have been looking at ways that they might do that, what kinds of things are allowed by the feds and that sort of thing. We are hoping to get a list of things that other states have done that we can share more broadly with our counties, but the key is that they do have their own county crisis plans and set their own policy regarding what they'll cover. So we have very much encouraged them to change those where it's appropriate to do so. And as I said, 48 of them have submitted changes to their crisis plans. Some of them already had pretty.
And Senator Berglund. I would just follow up to say I'm glad to hear that. I think that just in reflection with Senator Lynch's hearing something on the street, I'm not sure, but that I have also heard in our counties, they're very concerned about being up front and being first out of the gate because they're afraid they aren't going to get the money, they aren't going to be reimbursed. They're having more and more of state's responsibility shifted to them. They don't have the capacity to raise the revenue. And they start extending services in a variety of ways and then not have the resources or the capacity to continue to serve once they grow their caseload. So I think we ought to be, as a state, doing what you can to make sure that they are heard, what are their concerns, and then, you know, honestly answering their questions about what they can count on long-term and what's not, what they can't.
Senator Chair, we have been trying hard to make clear what is, you know, what is the short term and what is the long term and what can be done, and certainly do acknowledge their concerns about expectations that they may create and that sort of thing.
I know that the supported work money, the importance of that is that the more people you have in these slots, the more you can report that you have people employed, and if you don't have enough people in doing what the federal government defines as work, then you get penalized. And we were sent a letter, a warning letter, for one of our years of TANF, so, you know, if we would be penalized in the future, it probably would be a monetary fine. So, you know, it's important that we have those extra resources so that we can make sure we have as many people as possible in work as defined by the federal government. And I think the county should be more worried about being fined than being, you know, having too many people in the program or something. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Jane Rankin, Budget Director, back at the table. I want to go a little bit out of order on the handout because the program folks that you have heard from and have talked about the stimulus money, they've mentioned reporting requirements. In the stimulus legislation, there are general provisions about reporting on the use of the stimulus dollars, and that one of the key words in the legislation is transparency. And you might have also heard about reporting that will start October 1st or an October date around that. And what that is referring to is there's a section of the stimulus bill, section 1512, that requires recipients of stimulus funds to report on the amount of dollars spent, what they have spent the money on, and calculations of the numbers of jobs created or retained. For DHS's stimulus funded programs, those requirements apply to the kinds of programs that you heard everyone talk about, the senior nutrition, the community support programs, the child care programs. They do not, those particular reporting requirements do not apply to the increased FMAP for Medicaid. They don't apply to food support. They don't apply to TANF, and I'll get to in a minute, they also don't apply, we've learned, to the child support enforcement's incentive match program. But for the cases where these reporting requirements do apply, DHS has a 10-day window from October 1st to October 10th to have collected information from subrecipients, counties, and other grant recipients, and report to the federal government with numbers on spending, jobs created, jobs retained. There is guidance that it can be particular to the program about what your calculation is in terms of determining what is a created job or what is a retained job. I would say that for the stabilization funds that are being used in state-operated services and MSOP at DHS, those funds are being used for, they will be reported as retained jobs. So we will finish submitting those reports on October 10th, and then there's about a 20-day period where they're still preliminary. MMB here is reviewing and revising. The federal agency could be directing us to, they're reviewing, they might direct us to revise. All of that happens for the next 20 days. And then on October 30th, those 1512 reports will be final and they will be public and they will be showing up on the recovery.gov website. So at that point, then they're public for everyone to see. That sort of time frame for reporting continues then every quarter. At the end of every quarter, there's a 10-day window for state agencies to submit updated new information on what the stimulus money continues to be spent on and the jobs created or retained, and a 20-day period for revision, and then 30 days after the end of the quarter, it's public and it's on the recovery.gov website. If you've been hearing buzz about reporting for the stimulus bill, that's likely what you've been hearing about. There's also reporting going on, though, requirements in our other programs, like in Medicaid. I said this 1512 doesn't apply to Medicaid, but that doesn't mean that we're not reporting to CMS. CMS has added questions to their standard quarterly reports that we fill out, and they are tracking what the stimulus funds are being used for. We also, for Medicaid monies, have also a new report that seems to me to be designed specifically to focus in on those requirements of the Medicaid money that says we have to have maintained the same level of eligibility to be eligible for the stimulus enhanced FMAP, that we have to not be adjusting our local share in our Medicaid program. And that particular report is one that we are now in the process of reporting on. That will also be then done quarterly. I don't know that that will show up on the recovery.gov website, though. It probably would be, it would be more likely perhaps that it will be reported by the federal CMS. There's also other reporting we're doing on the food support benefits. In this case, they're having our folks use the standard report, but they've modified it with a couple of questions about what the increased stimulus money is for. We're able to do all that reporting partly because MMB has directed all state agencies to keep the stimulus money separate. So it's in the accounting system separate, and we are to report on it separate. And that is one of the key ways that we are responding to the interest and the need for transparency about reporting all of this money. Another piece that MMB has added recently is they are collecting information from state agencies for all stimulus programs. So for DHS, it's for Medicaid and TANF, as well as the block grant programs. And they are going to use information about location of where the money spent to develop a website that will have a interactive map, is my understanding, of the state of Minnesota, so that there's more location-specific information on where the stimulus money has been spent. But it's all something that all the agencies have been working to understand the guidances. The guidances have been conflicting in some way at some level, so it's been hard to figure out what guidance we're supposed to follow and what we're supposed to do. But a lot of people have been working very hard to get this reporting understood so that we're providing the information that, that folks need.
Ms. Rankin, when you do the reporting on the Medicaid FMAP, are you also required to tell them about the reduction in spending in Medicaid that will take place in total because of the reduction of the state share?
Madam Chair and members, it does look like there's this new additional report from CMS is designed to collect that information about what the impact on the general state budget has been of the increased federal share in the program, which therefore has meant a reduced state share in the program. So we're working through how we're to respond to that report.
But if we had kept our Medicaid budget constant, we would have had more FMAP dollars. And so I guess I'm trying to figure out if they're asking you the question about, I mean, if it's about jobs, you know, I suppose you could say we would have cut that much more and there would have been a reduction commensurate to the dollar amount in terms of jobs. But we did cut anyway. And so it's hard for me to understand how you report on the jobs when there's a reduction in the spending in the program from the base level spending originally.
Madam Chair, as you are talking, I'm trying to recollect what I have remember seeing from this new report. I don't recall that the Medicaid spending is cast in terms of jobs created and retained, but it is instead focused on the impacts on the state budget. It looked to me that they are collecting information. They wanted to know what a state has chosen to do with the quote-unquote freed-up funds, which would be the freed-up dollars that aren't needed to pay for as much of a state share for Medicaid, since we have an increased federal share for 9 quarters. It is.
So how do we answer that question?
Do we
just say we didn't have to reduce the spending by this amount because we had this money, that otherwise there would have been greater cuts in the state budget?
Madam Chair, our program experts are working that through and coordinating with, or we've had some discussions with MMB to make sure that the discussion about the impact on the state budget is consistent with the way we've experienced it here. But it's all in process. Our first report of that kind is due the end of October. And it's a brand new thing for us. So we're trying to figure out what the directions are and to get the information recorded that they're looking for. So with that, I just wanted to go back then to finish up on a few other programs or places where there's also been a stimulus increase, and I'm now back on page 4 of the main handout. There are a couple situations where the stimulus bill increased the federal FMAP outside of Medicaid for a smaller amount, but nonetheless, in the Title IV-E adoption assistance and foster care programs, those are both cases where there's a federal share paying for the services for adoption assistance and foster care maintenance payments. And there's been a temporary increase in the federal share by 6.2%. And we have in state fiscal year 9, we paid out $1.5 million of the increased stimulus money has gone out to pay for the adoption assistance costs of counties. And the same amount actually has also been paid out for counties' foster care costs in state fiscal year 9. And those are an ongoing situation, so we have just preliminary estimates reported that about $300,000 of this increased adoption assistance federal share has been paid out in the first quarter of the state fiscal year 10, and a little under $100,000 for the foster care programs.
In the case of the adoption assistance, will this increased federal funding then reduce the state expenditures that are needed to be made? Because it doesn't increase any families' grant they get.
Correct. So that the, Madam Chair, so that the counties are receiving the higher federal share on the services that they are paying out.
I'm talking about adoption assistance, not foster care.
Okay.
So the adoption assistance program is one where we send money out to families who are providing an adopted home for a child in need of adoption assistance. Families are not getting an increased amount. So is it therefore reducing the amount of state expenditures that otherwise would have to be made on the program?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that it's the county's costs that are being reduced. That you are correct.
Well, I understand that for the foster care.
The family.
I understand that for the foster care, but I'm not sure I understand that for the adoption assistance program.
Madam Chair, I will make a note of your question then, and I will have to check and get that detailed answer back to you and the committee.
Okay, thank you.
And then the last program area where there's stimulus increase is in child support enforcement. And what the stimulus bill has done here is that they have temporarily increased the federal match for child support enforcement funding. This is funding that counties have used to increase their child support programs in their counties. Essentially, what's going on here is that typically there's a federal share and there is a county share for child support enforcement funding. And for 2 years, the federal government is basically saying you can use, once we demonstrate that we have put enough money into our child support programs across the state that we qualify for what's called the performance incentive awards, then essentially the counties get to use the federal share as they get to substitute federal dollars for the local share that they would otherwise be putting into the programs. The impact of all of that is that for the 2 year period in federal fiscal 9 and 10, there's essentially another $15.8 million that's going to counties for their child support enforcement work. And because there is, there's sort of an ongoing then multiplier effect, if you will, that can happen, because once the counties have made the investment in the work, then they can claim federal match on their future activities, so that the effect of the stimulus money will continue beyond the 2 year temporary period when this incentive match can be used for their work. At this point, we can report that $4.15 million of this particular stimulus money has been received by DHS and distributed to counties. Madam Chair and members, then the last item that I wanted to talk about briefly is something that the health department can pick up on and continue the conversation with, because it's a situation where DHS has a role, but it's primarily health department work. And that is, in the stimulus bill, there's something called the High Tech Act. It's the Health Information Technology, Economic and Clinical Health Act. And what it does is it provides three new kinds of federal funds. There are 100% federal incentive payments that will be available for Medicaid and Medicare providers to encourage and support the use of electronic health records. There is a second stream of funding that will provide 90% federal match to the state expenses to plan and implement the administrative costs that are related to that those incentive payments. And this is all within larger statewide health information technology efforts. And right now, DHS is working collaboratively with the health department to plan for how these two funding streams might work to benefit the state. And we are developing our request to get ready to apply for some of that funding. Then there's another piece, the third piece in this High Tech Act is grant funding to support health information exchange. And there's information on that, a few bullets on that in your handout, but that's something that the health department will talk about in more detail. So that's the review of stimulus funding at the...
Are there any questions? Senator Rosen.
Yeah, hi, Madam Chair. Thank you. Ms. Rankin, on this collecting of the information that's being required for the federal dollars, have you had to just shift around people to do this collecting? Is it just part of something that's being assimilated into their workload, or have you hired some new people for this?
Madam Chair and Senator, we have not hired any new people at DHS to do the stimulus reporting. We are adding it to the workloads of folks in the agency and are just working hard to add it to the rest of what their jobs are at the agency.
Thank you.
Any other questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll move over to the Department of Health, and we'll be getting some information from Barb Julek.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Barb Julek from the Minnesota Department of Health. You should have two handouts. One's just a listing summarizing all the federal grants we have applied for or intend to apply for, and then a separate handout contains the same information with just a little more detail on what the grants are for, and that's primarily what I'll be speaking from today. Maybe to answer some questions on federal reporting to start with. Due to the timing of the awarding of these grants and the LAC process, we haven't spent any of the grant money as of September 30th. Although we haven't spent any money, we will still be required to submit our 1512 reports tomorrow to MMB and then October 10th to the federal government. And what that reporting will be is basically what we've received, how it's being budgeted, to the extent it will be allocated to subrecipients or other entities. We can detail that to what we know. But right now, the report, we do not have any spending on any of these grants yet. Starting with the handout, if you recall, the Department of Health ERA funds broke down into four categories. The first was prevention and wellness grants. The second was women, infant, and children. Third was primary care training, and the fourth was health information technology. Under prevention and wellness, we received two immunization grants. The first is immunization and vaccines grants for children and adults. $1.9 million was awarded to us. The award came in 2 weeks ago. This is on top of an $8 million biennial base. The funding is for 2 years. The funding will be allocated to local health departments and tribes who currently offer immunization services. In order to expand this activity with an emphasis on adult and adolescent vaccination programs, increasing vaccination programs either among providers, community organizations, or the public. The funding will also be allowed to be used for local grantees to purchase storage units or other operating type of equipment for their vaccination programs. The second immunization grant is an improving quality data for enhancing an assessment of immunization information systems in sentinel sites. This was a competitive grant that Minnesota applied for and did receive an award for. It's $155,000 to be spent over the next 2 years. The funding will allow Minnesota to expand its current Hennepin County Sentinel site into Ramsey County and St. Paul, allowing for better improved data across the broader area in the metro area. The funding will be used to conduct a survey of non-participating providers to understand barriers to participation in our immunization information and to conduct recruitment of providers with the goals of increasing participation. The next category under prevention, you may recall, was an overall prevention and wellness strategies. The federal government had allocated over $650 million nationwide for this. About 2 weeks ago, there was an announcement of $373 million being made available to local communities for application. There are additional pending announcements where we are assuming there may be some state potential for state awards, but right now we don't have that information.
Senator Rosen, did you have a question?
Well, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. Right now I see that it's for Hennepin and Ramsey County, of this information sharing on immunization. What's the process or the protocol right now for a sharing out in the other counties outside of just those two counties?
Madam Chair, I could get back to, I think the question is how many other Sentinel sites we have throughout the state besides Hennepin County.
And Madam Chair, Craig Aikum, Assistant Commissioner at the Department. Senator Rosen, to your question, currently our main method of sharing information about immunization in the state is through our immunization registry, which we refer to as MIC. This is an attempt, I believe, in the metro area to improve participation in MIC, where providers who provide the immunizations put that information into the registries, but then local health departments throughout the state are able to access that information for their local jurisdictions.
And Madam Chair, it's my understanding that about 86% of the providers currently participate, and the goal would be to increase that number.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why only 86?
That's part of what this money will hopefully find out. Part of this is to address what kind of barriers prevent or are what are the reasons providers aren't participating, and are there barriers that we can address?
You know, once we have all providers using electronic medical records, it would be so easy for them to submit this that,
yeah.
You know, it may be that if there are some providers that don't have the electronic medical records, it's the paperwork that they just don't feel they can handle to report it to their local health department. But in the future, it should be easier for them to do it.
Continuing on under the prevention and wellness grants, we did receive 4 grants under the healthcare-associated infection prevention. 2 of the grants, and unfortunately these are the 1st and 4th grant listed on page 2, are with the epidemiology and lab capacity grants. We receive a base funding under the epidemiology and lab capacity of about $420,000. This base money is split into a bunch of focus area projects that improve surveillance and response to activities among naturally occurring infectious disease and drug resistance infections. These supplemental funds, which include $653,000 over 3 years to develop plans and recommendations around preventions of healthcare associated workers or worker infections among healthcare workers. And the second grant is $138,000 over 2 years to conduct surveillance and investigations of varicella outbreaks. The second grant will allow the department to do increased surveillance through focused on 80 representative schools, conducting investigation of at least one outbreak and to assess the effectiveness of the varicella vaccine in one dose or versus 2 doses. So they're very focused area grants on how we can use them. The second set that listed as 2 and 3 on your handout are with the Emerging Infections Program. The Emerging Infections Program receives a base of about over $1 million that allows us to conduct surveillance and epidemiology and public health activities for emerging health infections. The current base funding is also dedicated to special focus areas that include such things as Lyme disease, West Nile virus, and other foodborne illnesses. The new funding came in 2 pots. The first, $404,000 over 3 years to develop, again, plans and recommendations on healthcare worker-associated infections. And so we'll be focusing on developing those plans and recommendations. And the second one is a vaccine effectiveness study, which will allow the health department to expand current studies on vaccine effectiveness, particularly the H1N1 vaccine and how that's working. Any good questions on that? Move on to the Women, Infant, and Children's grants. We have applied for and have a pre-award notice of funding for the WIC Management Information System. Our application was a little over $4.5 million, and award is a little under $3 million. But this funding will go to replace the WICS information systems with a new web-based information system that meets the USDA requirements. Funding will be used to purchase equipment, hardware, software, technology systems, and the like. The third area is training of primary care providers. We received two award notices in this area. The first is, you may recall, the state loan repayment program, where we requested for and received a match from the legislature, $128,000 state match plus a $20,000 private donation that will allow us to draw down $148,000 in ARA funds for this program. This program allows loan forgiveness for qualified primary care providers. We went through this spring.
So do we have an idea of how many more slots will be created?
About seven, a little over seven.
About seven, okay.
In addition, we have been notified there may be additional funds available, provided there is additional match found.
And how much more do you believe would be available?
Probably another 128, Madam Chair.
Do we think we will have the local match donated somehow?
I'm not aware of any volunteers.
Okay.
28,000.
The second.
And how long is this funding available?
I believe the second round would be available for next fiscal year 11. It's for 2 years. The second grant we did receive under primary care training was $107,000 over 3 years. That will go to the office of the Minnesota's primary care office. Funding would be used to increase our recruitment and retention activities of healthcare professionals for medically underserved areas.
And how many do we think will be created in this category?
How many do we think we can recruit and retain?
Uh-huh.
I don't know that we know.
Okay.
We can get back to you with what we.
All right.
The last area, again, is a topic that we went through last session. Funding is available for states to apply under the State Information Exchange and Cooperative Agreement Program. Last session, the legislature did provide $350,000 in fiscal year 10 and $175,000 in base funding to allow us to use for match for this program. We have been told we could apply for up to $9.6 million. That would be used over a four-year time period. The funding would fund activities that facilitate and expand the electronic movement and use of health information among organizations according to nationally recognized standards in order to improve quality, safety, and accessibility of health care. And if you have any specific questions on this, Mr. Golden is here.
Well, I think one of the questions that I have, I recently learned that some of our providers that already have electronic medical records and actually use the same vendor have required the vendor to insert things into their program that would not allow the information to be exchanged. And I'm just wondering if there's something that we need to do to make sure that that doesn't continue.
excuse me, Madam Chair, committee members, Jim Golden, Director for the Division of Health Policy. Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any providers who have instructed their vendors not to put things in.
No, to put things into their program that would not make their information automatically exchangeable.
I haven't heard that story, but I can relate to you some things that are going on. The Office of the National Coordinator at the federal level is very interested in ensuring that each of the 50 states has a state solution for the exchange of information so that there'd be a state-level exchange. As part of the $9.6 million that Ms. Julich talked about, there will be a lot of requirement for us to start thinking about initially how do we exchange data with our neighboring states. So to the degree that we have providers and patients that are crossing, for example, our Wisconsin border and our Dakota border, we are going to be held responsible for working directly with both the Dakotas and Wisconsin. And at the national level in the summer, there was quite a lot of interest in the vendors, the big national vendors, having a greater role in that as opposed to having it done at the state level. So from that standpoint, I think that's a settled, more or less of a settled debate. And where the national vendors tend to be on this is they are putting together their programs and their software to meet the requirements that are called meaningful use at the federal level. So one of the things that came out at the federal level is this concept of meaningful use, and that the idea of meaningful use is that in order to be using your electronic health record to get your Medicare or Medicaid incentives, you have to be using them by putting in certain information, exchanging certain information, having certain types of information available to you when the patient is there with you. And pretty much that is the national direction that everyone is moving. They're putting money into the states to move in that direction in exchange. The vendors are building their programs to meet those requirements. And so we haven't heard of
anything. So this may be a problem that in the future will take care of itself.
Yeah, I would be surprised
that
this is a problem.
Whatever was put in will be told to be taken out.
It's very hard to get that custom programming.
Well, I think that the attitude in the past has been a little bit that this is proprietary information, but we need to remember that it's really our health records. And, you know, if I want my health record to be transferred from one provider to another, there shouldn't be a barrier. It's either my premium dollar or a state dollar that has gone to make it possible for this investment to take place. And so the health record should be able to be exchanged if I choose to have it happen. It should not be proprietary information, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions about any of this so far? Well, good luck with the grants you're receiving. The last item we have on the agenda today is just a little bit of an update about some information that we just received in the last 2 weeks from the federal government regarding federal Medicaid and Medicare pilot project for medical homes.
Madam Chair, Shannon McMahon from the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair, I'm Kristen Lonkridge.
I invited Ms. Lonkridge to come up and join us because both departments have been partnering very closely on the development of the healthcare home standards as well as the department, as well as the payment methodologies. Just a little general background, and Madam Chair knows well that one of the things that we've talked about extensively about healthcare home is needing critical mass, and what this proposal would do was bring us critical mass. It would bring together sort of all the payers, Medicare, Medicaid, the private sector, and, of course, our provider partners. And so I want to start off by saying that our information on this is pretty limited. You're actually about to get everything we have. It's a press release and a fact sheet. Dr. Jeff Schiff, who many of you know, is our medical director, and he's actually out at the National Academy for State Health Policy Conference, which many of you are often at, as are we, but due to the budget constraints of the state. We're not there. But he is there as a guest of NASHP and is at a meeting right now trying to learn a little bit more about this and what it would mean for Minnesota. I think when we look at this, we think, wow, they were thinking of us. Clearly, they were thinking of Vermont. The governor of Vermont got some credit in this press release. But, you know, they talk about that they want states to apply for this who have advanced primary care models, who've done healthcare homes, who, you know, can demonstrate that a majority of their primary care providers would participate. We actually have some data and some surveys from both ICSI and some of our own data that suggests that more than 50% of our primary care providers want to be healthcare homes. So, you know, that bodes well for us should we have the opportunity to bid for this. And I guess, again, you know, it uses a lot of the concepts that we talk about, being patient-centered, being having a team approach, coordinated care, looking at people who have complex medical needs. So, again, it sort of speaks to the language that we've all been speaking, certainly that this committee and the House have been speaking about this. And just to sort of underscore the partnership between DHS and MDH, DHS has been responsible for developing the payment methodology for healthcare homes, and MDH has been the lead on developing criteria, and we've collaboratively developed evaluation tools and methodologies to see how effective the healthcare home model will be going forward. So, you know, we look forward to seeing the guidance from CMS, having the opportunity to put forward our proposal, and I'll let Ms. Lonkridge give any other details that, you know, from the MDH perspective about what we think about this idea.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. As Ms. McMahon said, we are very interested in pursuing a state application for this demonstration project, and we appreciate that the federal government has heard the feedback from the states on the need for Medicare to participate in this medical home pilot project. We often hear from providers and the health plans that all payers need to participate in this payment reform type effort. And as Ms. McMahon said, DHS and MDH are working together and talking with our stakeholder partners and exploring how this project could be implemented. And we do need to make this a public-private partnership for this to be successful. This project has been described by the federal government as being cost-neutral to Medicare on a state-by-state basis. And we need, you know, we're trying to explore that right now with the federal government, but we need some assurance that participation in this project would not further lower Minnesota's low Medicare reimbursement rates. So that's kind of the guidance that we're waiting for the federal government.
Questions? I noticed that the application would be made this fall with implementation early in 2010. So maybe as you get more information about this, you can pass it on, and we'll make sure the members of the committee receive it.
Madam Chair, as soon as we receive any additional guidance from the federal